afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm here with my co-host today, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Friday, June 22nd, 2018. Good afternoon, Dave.
Happy Friday, Melody.
Happy Friday to you. And we just have a short segment today because we have James Corbett for the second and third segment today. So, gee, Dave, I'll miss you.
Hey, I'll be listening.
You'll be listening? All righty. Well, let's go ahead and get to the market report today for June 22nd. It's Friday. On the New York spot price after market, gold is up $3 at $1,270.90. Silver is up 16 cents at $16.55. Platinum is up $12 at $879. Palladium is up six at 962. So it's nice to see all the commodities, precious metals stronger today. You have the USDX today is trading lower 0.31 at 94.54. And holy smokes, crude oil today. I guess didn't the Saudis make some sort of an announcement today, Dave, that they're going to increase production?
Indeed.
And we have James Corbett talks a lot about the oil situation in the second segment today. So listeners, make sure you stay tuned. So I'm shocked, though, to see that statement brought crude oil up $3.62. That's huge at $69.16. And there's got to be more to it than that, Dave.
I don't know. I think just the fact that it had started to slip. I think the market didn't need a whole lot of news, to jump up. I think it's just sort of a symptom of what's been happening in the other markets, particularly the paper markets, where news that's not all that drastic, has resulted in, major ups and downs on a daily basis. So there's something lurking between the lines and beneath the sheets. I just wouldn't be surprised if it's just, a market that's reacting to good news for it after a little bit of slippage.
We have the Dow up 119 points today at 24,581. It had eight down days in a row, and I heard this morning if it had finished to the downside the day, it would have been the first time that that had happened since, the 40s or the 50s or something. So it's a rare and unusual, but so they managed to keep it to the positive side today, so they didn't have to worry about making a new record. So the NASDAQ, though, was down 20 points at 7,692, and the S&P was up 5, 2,754. You have the 10-year yield holding at 2.90%. Of course, the euro was stronger, 117, and European and Asian markets were pretty much a mixed bag. London moved the most overnight, but a little quiet. And I think anyone watching China's market, I'm surprised that broke down through 3,000. I saw it this morning on Bloomberg, and it was at 28 something, and it was just like, wow, that has had some nasty days. And I always said I thought that their stock market should be hovering around 2,500, about 2,300 to 2,500, and well, that's where it's headed. But we'll see what happens. There's certainly Bitcoin was down pretty good today, Dave, over almost a little over 7.5% on the day. So, you have the President Trump. There was another tweet today about another tariff. And this time this tariff would target imported autos from the European Union. The president said on his feed that if the EU does not remove duties on U.S. cars, then the U.S. will have no choice but to act. And, of course, this just came 2 days after Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said no decision had been made on whether the U.S. would extend the volley of tariffs it had imposed on other goods to the automobile industry. So the 20% tariff would be a bit smaller than the 25% levy that Trump had previously threatened, Dave.
Yeah, the The president has railed against unfair tariffs, Melody, that have been slapped on U.S. goods in other countries, and has vowed to reduce the trade deficit, you know, the country has with other nations, particularly China, as part of, you know, tariffs expected to go live July 6th. The administration has put a 25% tariff on Chinese goods, including autos. China, in turn, has promised dollar-for-dollar retaliatory tariffs. Auto tariffs are part of a broader strategy the White House has, in which it has deemed duties on U.S. exports to be a threat to national security. Trump has directed the U.S. Trade Rep to fine another $200 billion worth of Chinese imports for tariffs of 10%. Meanwhile, in Mexico, Melody.
Well, the rebooted Chevy Blazer. That is part of GM's attempt to make SUVs in all shapes and sizes to quench America's insatiable thirst for big cars. And the Blazer is bigger than an Equinox, but it's a little smaller than a Traverse. And but GM hasn't made a Blazer since 2005. Certainly doesn't look like the old one, but like the original one. So they're aiming it at a younger audience. And why then is GM building such a high-profile SUV aimed at an American audience in its Ramos, Mexican plant? Well, Mexican plants have cheaper labor costs than the United States, and GM's Ramos plant is already set up to manufacture bigger cars, including the Equinox SUV. And it also makes a smaller hatchback cruise there, too. So GM actually has three assembly plants in Mexico, and the company employs about 15,000 there.
The decision to build autos in Mexico is full of controversy. I mean, the Trump administration has threatened to penalize automakers that import cars and trucks to the U.S., and the White House is also seeking changes to NAFTA, which currently allows free movement of vehicles and parts across the U.S. borders with both Mexico and Canada. Now, vehicles built in Mexico and Canada and sold in the U.S. market use many parts built in U.S. factories. GM's not alone in building vehicles in Mexico for the U.S. market. All the major automakers have plants in Mexico that build cars and trucks, mainly for the U.S. market. But the industry's gradually returned to the U.S. over the past decade. And, you know, American auto sales have climbed overall since the Great Recession. And automakers have brought back many of the jobs at U.S. plants. GM employs 103,000 now in the U.S. And that's about a third more people at U.S. auto plants than GM employed in 2009. Just GM. So the last time the Blazer was built in 2005, it was manufactured in three plants that have long since closed, one in Ohio, one in New Jersey, and one in Pontiac, Michigan.
You know, sometimes it always seems that these auto manufacturers is just a day late and a dollar short, because higher gasoline prices, if it's being aimed at a younger generation, they don't have the funds. I mean, you know, when you're talking about, you know, gasoline rises, they're not going to be going after the gas guzzlers. So it'll be interesting to see if it's a success.
It will be.
Bringing it back at this point in time.
Those old style Blazers they're classic cars now. I mean, they're classic muscle cars, as I'd call them. Initially geared more for men, but in today's world, particularly among millennials, that muscle look goes both ways, so to speak. I speak mainly of like the Jeep Wrangler, which is very popular among females, according to reports that I've read. So yeah, you're right though. I mean, you got to believe the old Blazer probably got 10 or 12 miles to the gallon. You got to believe this one with technological improvements will, you know, get at least 15 to 20 on the highway, one would hope.
But it makes a big difference with those higher gasoline prices. So
indeed.
Hopefully they'll be successful, but I don't know, you know, with the youth today, I mean, they are geared. I always thought the youth today would be geared towards more smaller vehicles, but, you know, it's just baby boomers and so forth. Those who grew up with bigger vehicles, the younger generation grew up with smaller vehicles, so
and hybrids to boot.
And exactly. So interesting. So again, it's a day late, but we'll see. What's next? What else do we have on the program today? Russia. You know, this is interesting. A year ago, about half of the Americans considered North Korea the greatest immediate threat to the United States. We all know that that number has plummeted since they had the summit. But the fear of China has increased to the point where the two nations are essentially tied. This is according to a new Axios poll. So why should we care? Well, you have the Chinese president, Xi Jinping, has bluntly outlined his vision to take his country to superpower status by 2020. And they want to knock out the United States in the process. So you have the two nations, recent clashes in trade, national security, and tech have made Americans fear China as much as a rogue nuclear power that was headed by a dynastic autocratic leader. What are some of the key results of this poll, Dave?
Well, first, Melody, Russia is, as you mentioned, the greatest perceived threat, and the share of Americans who believe so has risen in the last year from 18% to 29%. Fear of ISIS remains consistently high, despite the fact that the terrorist organization is reportedly losing territory in Iraq and Syria. 22% of Americans believe it's the greatest threat, and that's down from 24% a year ago. Now, those who believe China's the greatest threat has risen from a mere 6% a year ago to 19% today. You know, of the threats from China, the poll shows that 62% of Americans are concerned by China's economic power, a little more than half by its technological advancement, and a little over a third by its military strength. And then, interestingly, North Korea's threat perception dropped by over twofold, from 49% last year to just 19% this year. Note that, as Melody alluded to, that 19% figure reflects Americans' view as of June 18th, which, of course, is after the Singapore summit.
You know, what's interesting on that is that the 62% are concerned about China's economic power. But I'll guarantee you that same 62% of Americans are not concerned about America's economic problems. So it's like, how can you have that many Americans concerned about their economic power? And, you know,
That's a paradox, whatever the right word is. That'd be interesting. Well, I might have to look further into that because, that could say something about American attitudes.
Yeah. And something else about that, I would think that, and 51% by its technological advancement, to me, I think military strength should be the number one concern, you know.
Well, maybe it will be next year.
Maybe.
I think there's the perceived threats of cyber attacks. Also, you know, with some of the more recent technological advances China companies have made on the internet, Alibaba and so forth. So that's just my guess why that number is a lot higher right now than military strength.
Well, yeah, it's just that's true. But, well, since we're talking about foreign countries, let's go ahead and go to, we're going to talk about Russia now. And it's interesting because the current administration is planning for a summit in Europe next month with President Vladimir Putin. This was the U.S. national security officials are saying that one of the most urgent issues will be Moscow's covert intrusion into American politics. The issue poses a significant test for President Trump, who has been criticized for doing too little to respond to Russian invasions of the 2016 election. How insistent will President Trump be when he has his chance with Putin?
Well, That's a good question, Melody. You know, an immediate concern of our top officials is, you know, Russia's efforts to interfere with the mechanics of voting and their tabulation. You know, our guys, top officials, that is, have said that, you know, the Russians successfully penetrated the voter registration rolls of several U.S. states prior to the last presidential election. You know, that's in addition to the propaganda efforts that we know now existed through Facebook and other platforms, which far exceed the methods used by other countries in foreign elections. In fact, our Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, told the Senate back in February, you know, we expect Russia to continue using propaganda, social media, false flag personas, sympathetic spokespeople, and other methods of influence to try and exacerbate social and political fissures in the United States. Melody.
Well, you know what? It's just like we do it to other countries. And, you know, and it's like... not to say that it's you know, I'm not saying that it's okay to do it, you know, I mean, but you would think that instead of actually, how can I put this without, yes, this should be, you know, if Dan Coats believes or expects Russia to continue using propaganda, social media, and so forth, stop it.
Yeah, that's I can't believe,
you know,
that
just
it can't stop, be
you know,
stopped.
That it can't be stopped.
That it can't be blocked. That
you know, so come on, you know, instead of you know, everyone's just saying collusion, well, stop that too. Fix the problem. Don't allow it to happen. Do what needs to be done. And no one comes up with you know, possibilities or solutions. I was taught a long time ago, you know, my bosses used to tell me, you don't come to me with a problem unless you have a solution to go along with it. But all we hear out of, which is nothing any different from D.C., all we ever hear time and time again is just whining and moaning and groaning, but never any solutions. And
certainly, bring us the problems.
So actually no action on it either. But, hey, we're just about out of time, so I want to tell the listeners 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And we're going to talk about this on Monday about Social Security checks.
Do we still have any specials for people? Is that silver special still running, Melody?
We still have some available. The 50-cent pieces circulated, 90% silver, $25 face value little bags, and that is $325. And you notice, ladies and gentlemen, the price has been rising, and I've been keeping it the same. So give us a call at 800-375-4188. Dave, we'll be heading into a break. I'll talk to you later. Ladies and gentlemen, please enjoy my interview with James Borman. You're listening to Finance and Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseVoicesOfIntegrity.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Discount Gold and Silver Trading Financial Survival Program. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And, of course, James Corbett is the founder and editor of The Corbett Report and also the editorial writer for The International Forecaster, which is the weekly newsletter that was created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. And you can view James's work at thecorbettreport.com and theinternationalforecaster.com. Good evening, James.
Well, good evening, good morning, whatever it is. I'm here and I'm ready to go.
Well, let's just say good afternoon, too. Let's get them all.
We'll meet in the middle. There you
go. Okay. There's a lot of things to talk about. There was a few things, some lighter responses, but I think we're going to get, you recently had an article, or you wrote an article, titled India and China announced the oil buyers program. In it, you wrote about an oil conference that slipped under the radar, the International Energy Forum in April. And you talk about an interesting development that emerged from this conference. Would you like to tell us about it, James?
Yes. So for people who missed it, yes, the IEF's 16th Biennial Energy Ministers Meeting took place in New Delhi in April. And that was a meeting of 50 of the world's energy ministers, 30 energy company CEOs, 12 heads of international organizations, all there to talk shop about the international energy market. So, of course, first and foremost on most people's minds was the oil cartel, OPEC, and what it's going to be doing or not doing at its upcoming meeting with in the next several hours. And as part of those talks, on the sidelines of that particular meeting, the Indian Petroleum Minister, yes, they have a Minister of Petroleum, Dharmendra Pradhan, I hope I'm saying that right, met with his Chinese counterpart to talk about an idea that India has had for a while, actually. They first proposed it in 2005 under a different oil minister, but are bringing back out of the closet to talk about again the idea of an oil buyers club. And basically, this is the vision of bringing together India, China, South Korea, Japan, perhaps other Asian nations. But those four nations in particular make four of the top five oil importing nations in the world. So they have some buying clout in the markets. But they are not treated very well by those markets. In fact, OPEC puts what it calls an Asian premium on sales of oil to those countries in Asia. And basically, India, China, they're starting to realize, well, we're getting, well, maybe they've realized for a while, but they're particularly feeling it now as the oil price is rising again. They're getting the short end of the stick. They want to get a little bit of a going to, or at least they're talking about banding together to create an oil buyers club that could exert a bit more pressure on OPEC and oil producers generally to cut a more amenable deal for oil purchases. And I think this is significant for a number of reasons. Obviously, I think one of the things that it talks about or points to is the fact that India and China and some of their Asian nation brethren have been and will continue to be, likely for the foreseeable future, drivers of global growth generally. And, of course, emerging and developing markets are always hungry for oil. So I think the question of how, well, China in particular, India increasingly so, how they are going to source and basically protect their oil interests around the world is going to be an increasingly important point in coming years. And we've definitely seen China hungry for Iranian oil and gas in the last couple of months, specifically as the U.S. and others are threatening to sanction. China is more than happy to step into that void. And also, the question of OPEC and the Asian premium is certainly one that's going to to be hitting closer to home. So India is basically trying to, I think, get in the driver's seat of this one and cut a better deal. It'll be interesting to see how this shapes up, but it's very likely that we're going to see some of the largest oil importing nations in the planet in a type of counter OPEC. Well, if the oil producers can get together in a cartel, why can't the oil buyers?
Well, it seems like, I mean, this is setting up to where it's going to be them versus, you know, two groups. It sounds like it's leaving the U.S., you know, in the dust. And but yet you see a relationship between OPEC, Israel. It seems like that's growing stronger, or maybe it was always strong, but just overlooked. So if they're setting up, if the buyers are setting up, creating this force, where does that leave the United States?
It's a very good question, and it's an increasingly important question for global trade, isn't it? And obviously, I think we're not just talking about oil at this point. We're talking about the direction of global markets generally and the orientation towards the East, Asia. Again, generally has been a significant driver of global growth and is going to continue to be so if China gets its way with its One Belt, One Road, or if India emerges as the new dominant power of Asia, as the U.S. has been trying to position them as recently, even renaming the Pacific Fleet into the Indo-Pacific Command. There are some definite changes that are coming, and I think that we're going to see more orientation of global markets generally towards Asia. So this does mean that, of course, if global trade is a zero-sum game, or at least is a slowly expanding pie, then when some players start to take up a greater share of that pie, other players are going to lose out, and the U.S. is the one, one would imagine, would be the first to feel these effects, which is probably a large part of the reason why we're seeing the development of this. Is it a trade war? I'm not sure if it is yet, but at any rate, the first shots have been fired in whatever is happening between China and the U.S., and I think this is part of this grander struggle that's going on right now for share of the global markets.
Well, if we see, you know, like India, and they create there's, I'm going to call it a zone, because I think that's eventually what the world is going to be, you know, designed by. There are going to be zones and so forth. So if they have their zone, I mean, the United States could fare well, because they're going to need, because, I mean, India's, the amount of trade that could be generated, but yet it's not going to, I can't see it being on our terms. I mean, because of the power and just the sheer numbers would dictate what we would have to do to take advantage of their growth. So
yeah.
Our growth is going to be based, can our growth, the United States growth, be based on our own growth, or it is truly dependent on the bigger picture?
Well, it hasn't been independent growth for a very long time, going back at least a couple of decades now. And in fact, it was in, I think, 2006 that historian Niall Ferguson coined the term Chimerica to describe the symbiotic relationship between China and America's economies, which was the driver of global growth at that time and is still a significant part of global economic growth. And so, obviously, the U.S. has been quite dependent on its relationship with China. Obviously, China supplying the cheap slave-made plastic nonsense for the Walmart buyers in the U.S., and the U.S. happy to send its U.S. dollars over to China so that they can amass the massive reserves that they've had over the last several years. And that has been some sort of stable relationship of some, whatever kind of quotation marks you want to put around that. At any rate, it has persisted for a couple of decades, but obviously the U.S., I think, is questioning its relationship with China at this point, and I think lining up to try to make that same type of relationship happen with India, who the U.S. sees as more of a dependable ally than China. So that's why, as I say, we're seeing this shift toward the Indo-Pacific, and I was writing about that in the Forecaster just a few months ago, America, China, and the battle for the Indo-Pacific, where they're talking about India as being a responsible partner in the Asia region that can be a good partner for the U.S. And I think, obviously, there are geopolitical, geostrategic, military objectives there, but a huge portion of it perhaps the driving portion is the economic portion. And they see India as a potential roadblock to the One Belt, One Road of China, this trillion-dollar trading strategy that China's trying to roll out and basically connecting everyone in the region to China. Well, India could be a roadblock of sorts. It certainly has the population, the growing economy, and to some extent, the geopolitical and military clout. I mean, it is a nuclear nation. So it can stand up to China, and I think that's what the U.S. would like to see, because again, I think the U.S. finds India more amenable to its interests than China. Right. So that's the type of situation that's being engineered right now. But India could reject that and could end up partnering with China in some way. Obviously, they are partners in the BRICS, in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, in a number of other formats. And they have been playing a bit, shall we say, hard to get. For example, not attending China's inaugural One Belt, One Road shindig that they had in Beijing last year because of disputes about the Chinese-Pakistan relationship, for example. But they could start cooperating, and that's certainly one way that this could go, and is something like the Oil Buyers Club might be a signal that perhaps they're more willing to start cooperating with China than being that roadblock that the U.S. seems to want them to be.
Well, we often see OPEC make all these types of arrangements and so forth, and, you know, they eventually fall apart. No one follows through. We've seen it with OPEC and Russia and so forth. So is this, are we thoughts being put down on paper? Do you think this will really usher through, or is the driving force of trade of these countries so strong that it's just a matter of time until all these pieces come together and something new is born, I guess?
Yes. I think it's one of those things where you won't really know that it has happened until it has happened. But that doesn't mean you can't see the writing on the wall. And that writing is becoming more and more voluminous as we approach this transition point in history. Clearly, we are moving towards a new multipolar world where China and India and Russia and Iran and probably others in that orbit will have, if not equal weight to the world unitary superpower, the U.S., at any rate, they may become more self-sufficient and less dependent on their relationship with the United States, creating an alternative trading bloc. And we're starting to see that. And it's one of those things where there are a million different stories that you could point to. The Oil Buyers Club is just one of them. But there are, on more and more issues, in more and more ways, more and more opportunities for all of these countries to come together in various organizations and compacts, economic and political and military as well.
Which leads us back to, as you mentioned in the very beginning, is it a trade war or isn't it? And, you know, Michael Snyder in his week's edition of The Economic Collapse, he talks about the global financial system. Are we in a full-blown trade war between the two largest economies of the entire planet right now? And are these tariffs timely?
Well, I guess it depends. Yeah, that's an interesting question, because it certainly depends on what the ultimate intent is and from which perspective you're looking at. I think the U.S. realizes that at this particular point, it has the trade leverage over China. It can slap $200 billion worth of tariffs on China. China cannot reciprocate dollar for dollar because they don't purchase $200 billion worth of U.S. goods. So, but China can exert pressure in other ways. They can start more heavily regulating some of the American businesses, the Nikes and the Apples and the Googles and what have you that are already over there. They can start clamping down on factories and doing more inspections and things like that. They can basically throw some spanners in the works and gum up the engine of global trade if they want to. But yes, that would be a trade war. And at this point, I mean, obviously these tariffs have just been announced. They haven't gone into effect yet. So perhaps this is just part of a bargaining strategy rather than an all-out trade war, but it is certainly heading in that direction. And it's very interesting to see what will result from this. I think if China can withstand the short-term pain that it is ultimately going to feel from this. Because, as I say, I think the U.S. has the leverage in this situation. But if they can withstand that, I think ultimately this places them only more firmly on that track that they're already on, the creation of the One Belt, One Road trillion-dollar alternative trading infrastructure for basically this exact type of situation, trying to go around the U.S. and basically wean themselves off of Uncle Sam as their major and most important trading partner. If they can affect that, then in the long run, China ultimately, I think, will be the victor in this, because the U.S. will lose its role as the single unquestioned unitary superpower. So I think that's what the U.S. is trying to avoid, and that's probably why these tariffs and sanctions are being leveled right now, when I think they'll have the most leverage, the most potential effect on China.
Is it possible? I mean, this is discussed all the time. China and the power to dump treasuries, would they go that far? Would that hurt that China, if they began to dump treasuries, would that hurt them more than dealing with the pain from the tariffs? Or would they use those treasuries as leverage?
Yes. Well, this is the question of the House of Cards, and when it comes tumbling down, who ends up losing? Well, everyone ends up losing
everyone
in that scenario.
Does.
Unless you have created an alternative, you know, House of Cards infrastructure to jump to before the old House of Cards tumbles down. And that's, of course, what China has been explicitly trying to do for several years now. We had the People's Bank of China governor back in 2009 arguing that the IMF special drawing rights should become the new world reserve currency. So they've been talking about this for a while, and they've been positioning the yuan to be not, I think, the world reserve, but at least a reserve currency that can stand. And obviously it was added to the SDR basket a couple of years ago, so it is now technically a global reserve currency. And I think they're moving and positioning themselves for that changeover to happen. Are they there yet? Are they ready for that yet? No, of course not. They still have incredible amounts of U.S. dollar holdings and reserves that they've amassed, including in the form of treasuries over the years, and to suddenly dump them on the market would hurt themselves as much as anyone else, which is why I doubt they're going to do it right now. But I think they are positioning themselves so that it can be done at some point in the future.
Was there any other road other than tariffs to use to get what we need in order to position ourselves? I mean,
Again, it depends on which perspective you're coming at it from. But if you're coming at it from the Uncle Sam empire perspective, I mean, military moves are also an option. And perhaps that's a fading window as China starts to ramp up its military. But still, that is, I suppose if it's a question between trade war and hot war, I guess people would rather have a trade war, but it's not much of an alternative.
Well, I just want to mention real quick, your Prime Minister, Abe, is planning to visit Europe and the Middle East in July on a week-long tour that's going to include a signing ceremony for a free trade deal between Japan and the European Union. We're going to be heading into a break, so perhaps we can get your response on that when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back in just a few short minutes. Please stay tuned, and thank you for joining and listening to Financial Survival.
Just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again? Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again tonight? Each and every heart is
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett of The Corbett Report. Please visit his website, thecorbettreport.com, and also pick up the weekly issue. I guess it's twice weekly, theinternationalforecaster.com. You can go there and request for a free sample issue. But your website has some wonderful information, great information, and your articles are just, we reference them a lot on the program. So I want to thank you for taking the time to do what you do, because you do an incredible job, and it's I'm very appreciative that you take the time out to spend, because I know you're a very busy person, and I want to thank you for spending the time that you do with us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Going into the break, we were talking about how Japan's Prime Minister Abe was planning to visit Europe and the Middle East in July, and it's going to include a signing ceremony for a free trade deal between Japan and the European Union. And he is expected to visit Brussels on the first leg of his trip. And I guess that all begins around July 11th to sign the trade pact. What's your take on this trade deal, and how do you think it will play in terms of a continued or a new possible trade war with the U.S.?
Yes, well, it's interesting that this is coming at this particular time. Obviously, this has been in the works for a while, so I don't think we can see this as a result of the recent U.S. Policies towards its so-called economic allies around the world. But at any rate, it is coming together just as Japan and the EU and others are feeling the pinch of the withdrawal, essentially, of the U.S. from global markets. And what are they going to do other than step into that void that is being left by the global economic power and try to basically deal with each other more rather than going through the U.S.? And we see this, of course, with the when the U.S. pulled out of the TPP, the other TPP nations have decided to stick around and try to form some kind of compact. And now that Japan and the EU are being targeted by the U.S., here they are signing their own free trade agreement. And at any rate, this is just a signing ceremony that's going to conclude the negotiations, but then they have to take them back to their respective parliaments and get them ratified. So this won't take effect until 2019 at the very earliest, even if it is ratified, which is not guaranteed at this point. So still a long way to go, but and we'll have to see what the ultimate play out of the recent turmoil within the G7 is, and whether there's some accord met between those other members in the U.S. But it certainly does seem that a lot of people around the world are at the same time, I think, concerned and upset by what the U.S. is doing in its various trade disputes with various nations. But also, this is an opportunity for other nations to start basically transacting more directly with each other rather than always going through the U.S. as a type of trade proxy. So it is an interesting time to be living in. It'll be interesting to see how this develops. I don't think Japan and the EU have a huge trading relationship at this point, at least not as large as Japan and the U.S., for example. But it'll be interesting to see if that that starts to change given this new pact.
Well, when you think about Japan going out and signing these trade deals, and I'm not sure this has any bearing on, you know, these arrangements and so forth, but when you look at your population and the aging population, how does that affect future trade agreements for Japan, if at all?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure in terms of trade agreements, but obviously in just in terms of the economy in general, this is the central issue of Japan right now, or should be. It's the existential issue. In fact, if current population trends continue, and obviously there's a lot of things that can go on, but within a few centuries, the population of Japan will be down to something like 5% of what it is now, with total extinction of the Japanese people from the face of the planet within 1700 years, so they say. So at any rate, within by the end of this century, or even by 2050, we're going to see a significantly smaller Japanese population, and obviously the way the monetary order is structured and the way the economy is structured, it is predicated on growth, 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 growth. And if you have an actual shrinking population, then that will translate into a shrinking economy and a recession and potentially depression. And obviously Japan is already still trying to recover from the pop bubble of the 1980s. Can you imagine how much worse it could be if current demographic trends continue? So I think Japan is becoming a less favorable trading partner for some nations, or should be, at least in terms of its long-term prospects, which might be why Japan is eager to sign as many prep pacts as it can while the getting's good and while it's still a relatively large trading nation, because that could change in the future.
Well, but there's no signs of Japan cutting back on the stimulus that they project, that they inject into the economy. I mean,
Quite the contrary, actually. Yeah, the Bank of Japan just announced they're holding steady with their negative 0.1 short-term rate and targeting 10-year government bonds for a 0% yield.
Yeah.
So yeah, they are still holding steady to their loose monetary policy, and I think that's not what they want. It's just what they have to do, given the logic of the situation, because they had been predicting as much as 1%. Imagine that, 1% inflation. Back in April, I think that was their prediction for the year. Now they've reduced that down to 0.5 to 1%. As always, pronouncements by the BOJ and economic ministers here about, oh, inflation's going to get going any day now. Don't worry, it's going to pick up. it never, ever, ever, ever does, and they will just continue to leave that spigot wide open, because again, I don't think they really have a choice here.
Well, you know, we briefly mentioned the G7. I don't know, is it G5, G6, G7, you know, whatever number it might be. What, if anything, did this particular summit accomplish, and what do you think are the implications for the West of readmitting Russia or admitting China?
Well, what did it accomplish? It certainly brought into full view the testy trading relationship between U.S. and the other countries in the G7. So that, at any rate, it can no longer be ignored, and certainly came into view in a dramatic fashion, obviously, with my home and native land, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and Trump getting into a spat there at the end of the conference, and no joint communique, no joint statement being released for the first time ever. So it's quite a large and significant disruption in terms of the trading relationships and the kind of same old that we've come to expect from G7 conferences. So that was significant. But the suggestion, which I don't think is being taken very seriously by the other G7 members, but the suggestion, why not include Russia? Why not include China? I mean, it makes sense from every perspective. Again, it just depends on what the G7 is actually trying to accomplish. If it is trying to be a relevant organization where people come together to discuss global trade and make compacts and deals that will influence global trade, then you would want China, Russia, India, as members at that table, because they are some of the largest and growing economies on the planet. They have incredible economic clout and should be taken seriously. G7 might dwindle into irrelevance at some point in the future if they continue to withhold participation. But then again, if it is meant to be less of a actual effective economic grouping and more of just a talking shop for NATO allies to come together and sling mud at NATO enemies, then I suppose they can continue on the path they're on and basically ride that road right into irrelevance.
Yeah. How much does the media play into, you know, when they're reporting, and particularly because of Trump being Trump and the media, how they, you know, focus on something so trivial that, you know, probably the same thing was very similar, you know, in any other G7 meeting, and no one paid any attention to it. But now, because of the circumstances that we have, the media is, you know, accentuating, you know, not, you know, just adding to and creating more than what it is. Or there's no impact whatsoever. How the
yes,
media is reporting.
Yes, yes. Well, no, the media does. I mean, it makes such an important difference that we can't actually, I think, directly understand or experience it. It's like the fish not understanding what water is because they swim in it. And I don't think we can truly appreciate just how large a role the media has in shaping, not just shaping our expectations, but shaping the events themselves. And I'm obviously not old enough to remember, but I can appreciate that television changed the course of presidential politics in the U.S. when you could suddenly see these televised debates and, hey, look, here's this smiling videogenic JFK against this sweaty, strange Richard Nixon. Who's going to win that election? Well, it ends up being JFK. There is a difference and a change in the tenor of politics that creeps in when new media present themselves. We could even go back to the radio and the fireside chats of FDR and how that changed the way that presidents communicated with the nation. And now we're in the age of social media and Twitter and what have you. And of course, you know, Trump's latest tweets get more attention than anything else these days. So there is a change that is happening right now, and the media plays into that. And the way that the 24/7 news cycle of even of, you know, 20, 30 years ago when CNN first came on the scene is changing into the, you know, whatever it is, you know, however many seconds in a day. It's now a second by second news cycle, and the political attention span is becoming shorter and shorter as a result of that. It's a very strange era that we're living through, and I'd like to think at some point it will at least stabilize into something that we will be able to identify and discuss and talk about. But at this point, it's all changing so quickly and in such strange ways that it's difficult to know how this is going to how this is going to play out.
How is Asia reacting to the outcome of the Singapore summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un?
Well, I think everyone is cautiously optimistic. Not a lot really happened except for the suspension of the Korean Peninsula military exercises. Yes. That the U.S. has been participating in. That's a pretty significant development. And in fact, interestingly enough, it's one that the supposed erstwhile progressive left has been calling for quite a long time, saying it's Noam Chomsky and others saying, you know, it's a perfectly reasonable request that the North Korean government has been making for a very long time. If you stop holding these exercises, pretending to invade and conquer us several times a year, maybe we'll sit down at the table with you. Others have pointed this out for many years. But now that it's Trump doing this, now suddenly it's Rachel Maddow crying on TV about the Russian conspiracy and all of this. So it's fun. It's funny in one sense to watch the complete inversion of people and the complete abandonment of any political principles just because of whether the person in power has a D or an R after their name. But unfortunately, it's not that funny because obviously this is the world, the fate of the world we're talking about. As I say, people are, I think, cautiously optimistic, and hardly anyone, except maybe Rachel Maddow and her cohorts, could possibly see anything bad about true peace happening on the Korean Peninsula. And it's a very long way off towards even the possibility of some sort of reunification. But even if they just got their economies open and operating with each other, that would be a significant development. So let's hope this is going in the right direction. Unfortunately, given the way the statement was worded and the kind of lack of any development of any significance in terms of actual denuclearization or what have you, it's unfortunately leaving a lot of doors open for the neocons and others who still want war, or at least the threat of war, to drive through that door and basically create problems that would scuttle any hope for peace.
Did the Japanese diplomat who was dispatched by Abe report anything that we don't know about? Anything about what Trump and Kim actually talked about?
I didn't see any update about that, but yes, I might have had to learn about it the way we all did, basically watching the news wires.
Any updates on the Bilderberg conference?
You know, it's something that I've noted in recent years. I have not seen much, if any, intel coming from the Bilderberg meetings in the last several years. I can remember back in the era where veteran Bilderberg reporter Jim Tucker, for example, was reporting on the meetings. He would often have details of what was discussed in the meetings from his sources inside Bilderberg. I don't think anyone has those sources anymore. If they do, they're not spilling anything. All we get these days are the people who go, and hats off to them for doing it, the reporters like Dan Dix and Luke Rutkowski and others who go and go to the airport and get the Bilderbergers coming in and basically try to pin them down on camera. But of course, you don't generally tend to get much out of them in those situations. And I haven't seen any intel coming out from what was actually discussed inside. So unfortunately, although to be fair, Daniel Estulin, another veteran Bilderberg watcher, has recently said, well, there's nothing to talk about because they're not important anymore. They're the bygones of a fading political order, which may very well be the truth. Maybe Bilderberg is not as powerful as it once was, and maybe isn't setting the agenda in the way it was. But just given the caliber of the people that were involved there, or at least the net worth of the people that were involved there and the political positions they hold, I tend to think something of some significance was discussed there. But unfortunately, we just don't have access to it at this point.
Well, this week and on Wednesday, the Fed Chair Jerome Powell said that, you know, there's going to be two more rate hikes this year here in the U.S. Is the Fed on the verge of tightening the U.S. right into a new recession?
It couldn't work that way. At any rate, I think the developing markets have to worry about that because strengthening dollar and increasing rates have already affected developing economies negatively, and that could be yet another headwind for the global economy, which just a few months ago, even many were predicting a period of booming growth. I think people are starting to wonder if that is going to come true. And raising rates is the way to stop, you know, opening the spigot, but it could certainly have unintended consequences.
Thank you, James. As always, we appreciate your views and your insights. We'll talk with you again in 2 weeks. And thank you, listeners. That's all the time we have for today's program. And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, be safe and God bless.
I have a plan. If I got me, I will be.